Well, it's great to be here. IPAM is like a second home. I'm very happy because I think one of the four people that have read my book with Ulf came up to me yesterday and said they really appreciated my book with Ulf. The other three people are my wife, my 9-year-old daughter, and myself. My brother asked me how my books were doing. Snyder and Miller was referenced yesterday. I couldn't believe it. That was amazing. Sarang, you missed it. Guillermo referenced that book. So I said, I think it's selling well. All the libraries have bought a copy. He said, how many is that? About 1,000. I said, how are your books doing, Surya? He said, well, the Awakening the Buddha Within series is up to about 500,000 for the first one, and every other one is selling about 400,000. So, okay, we're in the wrong business here, if that's our goal, to sell books. So yesterday was wonderful. Lei Wang and Faisal won't be here today, but a lot of their work will be represented. They had personal issues. So I'm basically going to, I think, introduce the day and tell you where we are today, what our tools are in computational functional anatomy. So what computational functional anatomy is the study of function in anatomical coordinates. And what I mean by function is all the response variables that we study in anatomical coordinates, whether those response variables are derived from structure, or we often think about bold imaging as function. But function is really all the response variables that we study in anatomical coordinates. Now, as soon as we go to study them in anatomical coordinates, it presents all sorts of issues. We need tools. So one of the tools that we've, of course, all been developing is metric comparison. So how do we compare one coordinate system to another? And we've been using this technology called LDDMM, large deformation diffeomorphic metric mappings. That's a tool. The second tool we now have available is really a population model for anatomy. We really have a model of probability around structures, shapes, around the local template, and then variability. Once you have that, then of course you want to transport function. You want to transport function to these local representations. As soon as you do that, these representations are curved coordinate systems. So we have to think about all the things we've always done, but we have to do them on the curved coordinate system. So how do we represent signals in anatomical coordinates? And then finally, one of the technologies that have really emerged over the last several years is how to deal with multiple templates. How do we put information across template coordinate systems so we have balls that represent populations locally for each template? How do you share information? And for that, we've been developing, Laurent and Anchi have been developing parallel transport, and you'll be hearing about that in subsequent talk as we talk about time series models and other representations. So for metric comparison, we're using this framework in which we have two shapes. We imagine that we have a continuum of particles that fill them. So here's one particle. They flow under flows phi that are indexed over time t. Those flows are flows of homeomorphisms, and we want to differentiate them spatially, so they're diffeomorphisms. At time zero, of course, they're where they start, but then after one unit of time, now this is simulation time, so we're using this as a vehicle to ensure that we generate large motions that are still diffeomorphisms. So here it's not real time. At one unit of time, they're at some new position. We move particles so that essentially we can take a shape, let's call it the generating shape for the whole group, maybe we'll call it the template, so that we can take that shape and move it on to the target. We solve that using essentially shooting algorithms. So we define a correspondence function between shapes, whether they're images, whether they're landmarks, labeled or not, surfaces, curves. We have methods now for all of these. And we basically define a correspondence that says at time one, shape one should look like shape two. So that's what squiggle means, it should look like. So if they're dense images, then maybe there's an L2 norm between the action of the flow at time one on shape one should be close to in an L2 norm. But if they're points, then we think of them as measures or atoms, and then they're essentially measure norms that measure this closeness. And then we look for flows that essentially minimize a quantity that involves a smoothing on the vector field. That smoothing on the vector field, you can think of it as things like Laplacian operators to powers, but more generally, it's something related to the inverse of a Green's kernel so that the vector fields live in a smooth space. That smoothing, when interproducted with the vector field, gives energy. We call that smooth vector field the momentum. We now give it a symbol m sub t, because it turns out that the momentum is a very wonderful object in this metric space to model. It's a reduced dimension object. It's the natural thing to do statistics on. And so we'll be talking about that subsequently. And we basically look for flows that minimize this energy subject to matching correspondence. The metric then becomes essentially the infimum of the square root of this quantity, which is the usual integral of the norm on the shortest path of the flow of the vector field with respect to the smoothness that you've defined on the vector field. Now, the generalized momentum map, the momentum is the proper object to characterize shape and perform statistics on. It's opening up a lot of avenues. It's very powerful. Effect sizes, even that are small, can be studied in them because it's a very reduced dimensional object. So first off, in this setting where data only enters at the final time point, so we're not in the growth center, we're not in the growth setting where data is entering along the path, that will be different. There's a conservation law for the momentum. What we mean by that is that the momentum at t equals 0, m sub 0, so m sub t at t equals 0, we call it m sub 0, that completely determines the geodesic connection between shapes. So if you know the momentum at t equals 0, you can then flow the shape. And the way to think about this is that we've essentially solved Rosina's original problem from the 80s, Fred's before her, in which we added the condition that not only do you want a vector field that leaves the template, but as it flows, it stays homeomorphic or diffeomorphic. And that corresponds to this equation. So as long as the momentum is reasonable, if you flow under this equation, the flow of shapes stays in that setting. It stays in the space of shapes. These are a flow of diffeomorphisms. So this equation D is the Jacobian operator on phi. This means transpose, and essentially this is the equation of motion. Now, the momentum is normal to the level lines of the image, and that's a very nice thing. It really has to do with what we originally were looking at called the stabilizer of the group. That is, if you have a big flat object that's all black, it's obvious that if you move a particle around the level lines, you're not going to change the matching term. So there's an indefiniteness in that sense. There are many solutions, okay? So you want to move along, you want to move normal to the level line so that you don't move along all black, you want to change color. And so this solution has that built into it, so that's why it's minimum energy. You never want to take particles along the level line, you get nothing for doing that. The momentum coupled to the template is a highly compressed local representation of shape space, and I'm going to show you that. Meaning it's much more compact than the original vector fields. The vector fields are smoothed versions of the momentum through the Green's kernel. So the vector field can be everywhere, yet the momentum is concentrated on the object. Now, if you think about parcellating the brain, so I'm going to show you what Anchi's been doing over the last couple of years on subcortical networks. If you view it in MR, the subcortical structures, and they're all homogeneous and black, but different colors of black, or they're all homogeneous, then all the encoding goes to the boundary of the object, to the boundaries. The momentum is only on the boundary. So you go from vectors that are everywhere in space to a very minimalistic representation. And it's basically telling you that to put any more representation inside of this black object, which you can't see inside, you're wasting energy. So in statistics, the reason why we're seeing very small effect sizes and still being meaningful is because we're trying to exploit that. Large LDDMM essentially solves for the momentum that connects a shape to its target. So it's a code or a series of codes that essentially allow you to shoot one target onto the other, satisfying this conservation law. So just to give you a concrete example. So here is a group action. So here's one group action for a dense image. Here are two dense images. So here's one group action. Think of I as the template. It's an L2 norm, and it says the observable I sub D, I guess in Ulf's original notation, this is the distorted image through the MRI machine, is close to the original template put through the transformation at time one. The action here acts on the right through the inverse, and that makes it a group action. And then we satisfy this infimum. And to see that it's normal to the level line, so look, M0 starts off, and especially given by the determinant of the Jacobian of the transformation of time 1, weighting the data put through Fiat time 1 minus I, the original template, along the gradient of the image. So it's normal to the level lines. Now, to see that it's highly compressed, here are two examples. So here's a simple two blobs. Essentially, this blob is all one color, and this blob is the same color. It's a different shape. Here's what the momentum looks like. So the momentum is concentrated on the boundary and normal to the level lines, essentially. So it's zero everywhere else in space, as it should be. We shouldn't be saying things are happening out here. Yet the vector field is, this is what the vector field looks like. So the momentum is a very natural representation. Now, codes are emerging for combining many modalities, and I put this in because we're all talking about DTI and other modalities, so I wanted to just say a little bit about what Susumu Mori and John Sartoglu is doing and just show you why it's very natural to put multiple modalities together. So here are, of course, four modalities. Two of these come from DTI. Of course, Susumu has been working on DTI for a while, and as well, there are other imaging modalities. So by combining these modalities, a very natural thing happens. So what John did in his PhD thesis is he took these 3D brains, and I'm going to show you combining ISO and FA. ISO is more oriented towards gray matter, and FA is more oriented towards white matter. John put 100 features all throughout the cortex and 100 features all throughout the white matter. He used those as sensors or markers and asked in a whole family of brains, how closely after mapping do those markers go to each other? So this is the error in voxels. Voxel is 2 millimeter voxels. So this says 90% of the points were in white matter features. So there are about 100 white matter features. So using FA for the multimodality map, what happens is about 90% of the features after you do FA mapping using this methodology are within 2 millimeters. If you do nothing but do rigid registration, then 90% are within about 5 millimeters. That's how much variability there is after just rigid registration. If you use B0, which is the green line, it doesn't help you at all because it's seeing gray matter and it doesn't move them very well. If you use both, of course, you get the benefit of performance from the one that's basically moving that part of the anatomy. If you now look at the cortical features, again, you see if you use FA, you get very little benefit from cortical features. Now, they're some distance. Cortex is more variable, as we heard yesterday. We're sitting at about 90%, is maybe at 7 millimeters. And if you use both B0 and FA, then you can bring them down to about 2 millimeters. So this is what we're seeing for whole brain mapping. Now, of course, we're very interested in substructures. We've been mapping the hippocampus for a long time. There's an Anansky group and other groups. Of course, we're interested in the whole subcortical network. And so Anchi has been, Chu has been working for the last year, I'd say, on a whole series of subcortical structures, working with the MGH group as well as the San Diego group to basically get the subcortical structures right and then build our code so that we can map regions of interest the way that we map the hippocampus, which is this structure, but do all these structures. So I'd like to talk a little bit about where we are on ROI sort of analysis and look at momentum representations associated with these regions of interest. So first thing is I wanted to make the comment. What's shown here is the benefit you get from global template injection if you map them basically into segmentation. So we got segmentations on about 500 brains using well-known codes that we're all using. We can, of course, inject the global template structures into these by viewing the templates, although they're binarized, but by viewing the segmentations, although they're binarized, as essentially the target images. And so here's an example of mapping of one hippocampus that wasn't a particularly good segmentation for its level set, but when you globally inject the hippocampus, you bring the global structure, and that's of tremendous benefit. Here's another example. These are selected out of 500 maps to illustrate that not always is the level set associated with the threshold of segmentation. giving really good boundaries, but by bringing global properties. Now, the point I wanted to make was that yesterday we heard a lovely talk from a student from this group, not a student, a professor from this group. He's now in the department, and he was talking about bringing global information, and this is one way to bring in more global information. Well, not only has she done the hippocampus, but she's done all these structures in the subcortical network. So here's another example for the ventricle. Here's another example for the caudate. So we can imagine that we can now do region of interest injection. We can start looking at multiple structures. So now what I want to do is move in the direction of defining a random orbit model, essentially a local representation in shape space that will allow us to do many things. Once we have essentially a random model that describes shapes based on these momentum representations, we can do template estimation, we can do consistent estimation, we can do all sorts of things. This random orbit model wouldn't have come about without Alain and Laurent, in no particular order, sort of working with me over the last 10 years. So I really, I'm very excited about this model. We finally have a model that I think is a really lovely model. So we have a population of shapes. Of course, this could be the whole brain, but think of populations of shapes so we can get a handle on why these template and these orbit models are really local. Then the basic model is that we have a template, and there is some diffeomorphism, phi in the space of diffeomorphisms that are generated as flows that acts on the template to generate the object. Now, this generates the object in the orbit, not necessarily the MRI image. The MRI image is not smooth. It's not really in the orbit. It lives outside. It's the output of the sensor. So all these images can be generated this for different phis. Then to generate a random object in the orbit, basically we have this momentum at time zero. That's a vector space. It's in a Hilbert space. We basically can model it as a Gaussian random field. We can draw it randomly. So essentially we draw a random momentum, then we flow according to the conservation law, and then that generates the shape. And of course the estimation problem is to, given shapes or given images of shapes, MRI images, find, estimate, things like that. And then of course we have the imagery. Now the imagery is not necessarily in the orbit, so we don't want to have geodesics between the template and the imagery, the MRI imagery. We don't necessarily want to have we don't want to have diffeomorphisms between the template and the structures in the orbit and the MRI imagery. We understand that. That's the output of the channel in the channel model. But, of course, we now, in the simplest of models, we basically say the observable, the data, is a Gaussian random field. Now, it's essentially a conditional random field, so this is a fairly complicated model because the true underlying phi is hidden to us. It's a random object. It's back here. But it's a conditionally Gaussian random field. If you give me the mapping of the template and some covariance, and of course for image mapping, we've been using very simple covariances. So we have models like this now, and so we can set up very nice problems and estimation problems that make sense. So here's an example. So we have now template generation algorithms that essentially solve the maximum likelihood problem or problems like that for this random model. So the first thing is we start by saying the template is modeled as most likely under the random orbit model given the population. So you stick in a bunch of shapes and you basically want to estimate the template. So it's estimated as an unknown deformation of a hypertemplate. So to get started, we start with an object that's actually in the orbit. That's a smooth object that we can act diffeomorphisms on. We call that the hypertemplate. Then the complete data are the deformations mapping the unknown template to the population. So in this setting, if you knew the template and all the maps onto the population, those are extra nuisance variables. Those are like the complete data in the algorithm. And so then the E-step basically computes the conditional mean of the deformations onto the population given the previous estimate of the template and the observed MRI imagery. So to compute that conditional mean, we need a model. We need a probability law. And then the M-step maximizes the complete data posterior distribution with respect to the unknown deformation of the hypertemplate to the template. So it's this M step that produces the deformation of the hypertemplate to what you're calling the template. Now, we're gonna be hearing from Stephanie, who did the original work on this, not in the diffeomorphism setting, with Alain Trouvet and Yelia Meet, and of course, We picked this up about 2 years ago, and June Ma now has a series of papers on this kind of thing. I want to sort of show you pictorially what it does. I think it's very nice, and we're using it now to build local representations and build templates. So you start off in the EM algorithm at iteration one with zero momentum. So it's like the identity mapping on the original hypertemplate. Here's the hypertemplate. So zero momentum, you're not kicking the hypertemplate. So the template is just equal to the hypertemplate at time zero. Then what you basically do is, from here, in the complete data, you have to compute the conditional mean of the momenta that drive this object onto the population given the hypertemplate under the mapping. Well, there's no mapping, it's just the original object. Once you have the conditional mean, then you maximize and you get the new momentum or deformation that kicks the hypertemplate. So at iteration two, you now have your first output of a maximization, which is essentially a momentum that kicks the hypertemplate over to your new template. You then recompute this conditional mean. Given the conditional mean, you have a probability law that you maximize in the M algorithm. You then get M2. You keep doing that. At iteration N plus one, you have the nth one. You do it again. You kick the hypertemplate to the template, compute the conditional mean. And at convergence, everything balances. So essentially, M infinity, the new template at infinity, and then the conditional mean at infinity plus one, they're all stable, they don't change, and that's what allows you to prove that you've solved the original likelihood problem. Now, there are difficulties with this. We can't always compute the conditional mean in this complex space, even though Stephanie is going to talk about how to do that. So we compute the conditional, essentially the mode. So we've used this, Anchi has used this to generate this object, this template, which is essentially all these structures, seven on one side and seven on the other, based on a family of brains that came from MGH that were all hand labeled. So we generate one by hand, then we inject it into all the target labelings, we run this over and over, and we get a template for it. So, just to show you in 3D, that's what it looks like. And so now we're off and running because essentially once we have the template, it's relatively centered. Now, what I wanted to show you is, in this setting, the probability law is being built by the geodesic, that the energy in the probability law is given by the square of the metric distance between objects. So we should expect, when we maximize probability, that we're going to essentially end up with an object that tends to be close to the target population in this metric, in this geodesic metric. So what's shown here is, if I compute the geodesic distance between 6 of these of the target population, the geodesic between the hypertemplate and the targets, well, I get a metric distance of 9.6, 11.86, 12.73, and so forth. After running the algorithm, which attempts to find the maximum likelihood solution, we end up at the stable point, which is the estimated template. If we now look at the geodesic distance, it's often, not always, lower in the geodesic distance to all these shapes. It's essentially been centered. Okay. Now, let me turn to function. So, once we have this machinery, we now obviously want to put information in template coordinate systems. So, basically, we're going to transport the function, and I'm going to define various ways of transport. And transport, I'm going to tell you now, is the tricky business, and I expect we'll be working on this for another 10 years, all of us. Different kinds of transport. I'm going to show you the different kinds of transport we're using. But basically, once you have bijections, of course, we have a probability around a template of these objects. I just described that. But what you'd like to do is carry the color, which I'll call the function. The color that's out in these coordinate systems, you'll carry it using these bijections, these feeds. So we'll study functional response in atlas coordinates with many diffeomorphic correspondences. Now, again, I just want to say that for us, the things that we carry are what we'll label as F function, and it's all the response variables that you're interested in the original intrinsic coordinates that you want to bring back to a common coordinate system so you can do averaging. So the obvious one that we all think of when we think of function, we think of bold response. So here's an example from a paper with Craig Stark. In the medial temporal lobe, there were five structures here. And associated with each of the anatomical scans are, of course, the bold responses. And then we carry the bold response, which is a scalar, by transporting it. And I'm going to talk a little bit more in a few minutes, as you'll see, on defining how we should think about transporting function. Now I want to show you another example, because we've talked about that in the past, but I want to show you essentially a movie that we're all doing that is involved in growth that has to do with, many of us are doing, transporting DTI functions. So now I'm going to be a little bit more careful about how we transport. In the image case, let me just say again, in the image case, the scalar colors, we transport with right action by the inverse. So phi center dot I for dense images is I composed with phi inverse. Because that's a group action, acting on the right with inverse. Okay, now how do we do it when F is a DTI matrix? Well, since we've always used group actions, we liked what Alexander and G had done for vector information. So the way that it works there is, if F has eigenelements lambda and E, we basically look at the Jacobian matrix of the mapping, D of phi. We operate on the original eigenelements. We normalize them to keep their length. And we preserve the original eigenvalues. So the new phi dot f is given by this formula. The original eigenvalues with the eigenvectors now rotated, doing essentially Gram-Schmidt, and then phi inverse on the right side. And that's the group action. That's what we've adopted. Now, I'm going to say again that these transport how we transport is the focus of many, many groups. I don't just mean in DTI, but we just had a talk 4 months ago from the INRIA group that's not using this action for how they move the DTI matrices. So I'll just say again that this is part of the art and the modeling, and we're going to all be developing these kinds of definitions as we go forward. We don't always agree. So what I'm going to show you now is transporting the DTI information for growth into a common template coordinate system. So what I'm going to do, this is work that Nyonga is doing for her thesis with Susumu, is we have about 30 time points, 0 months, 7 months, 11 months, so this picks up on a theme from yesterday, of DTI of various neonates. And we're going to visualize the DTI function in the fixed template coordinates. No geometric motion. You're going to see no geometric motion. So I'm going to take all the geometric motion out, put it into the phis, and then we're going to just be looking at the function. This is a very natural thing to do, of course. Maybe it's this. So the color coding is the largest eigenvector shown in color via its direction. And I guess red must mean vertical. Green is vertical. Red is probably horizontal. And then there's another one into the board. And we're basically seeing the time series of about 30 points that have all been dragged to a common coordinate system, the thing we call the template. And we're hoping to only see geometric motion. Now, to do this dragging, Nyonga has inserted 300 landmarks throughout the brain in every one of these brains very carefully. We haven't removed all the geometric variation, and you can see that. If we had removed all the geometric variation, I don't think you'd see as much jumping, but we've removed a lot of it. We have to do better. We're working on it. But what you're basically seeing is now the functional signal all in a common coordinate system as it runs in time. And this is the original Michael Jackson video of the tiger into the man. There was no geometric motion. It was all just image value change, right? And we've coded the directions. So that's a nice thing to do. That's what we're all going to be doing and are doing as we look at functional responses in anatomical coordinates. So I want to move on. And I'm not going to show the heart stuff because I don't want to overdo this. So I want to get to the challenge now. If we're serious about this, then we have to be able to do this kind of representation in curved coordinate systems because, as we heard from Bruce and David yesterday, and as we see from the subcortical structures, they're all curved. Gyruses are all curved. So the principal tool that we're going to use is we bring the function to a common coordinate system. The function is of course encoded as as it gets carried by the bijection phi on f, we just showed you how we did it for DTI, we encode the transformations in the momentum vectors, that the momentum that pushes the template out to generate the structure, so there's the momenta, and then we essentially model the f's, they're all in a common coordinate system, using essentially complete orthonormal bases and what are going to essentially be Gaussian random field models. So we're going to expand the functions f in a complete orthonormal basis psi with random variables f, and these become our response variables. So we will be studying change in the function here by looking at it in the common coordinate system, generating a bunch of response variables, a big vector of response variables called the capital F's. They include the information, and we have a complete orthonormal basis that sits on the coordinate system. Of course, the coordinate system is not the unit square or the unit cube. The brain's not the unit cube. So we have to have ways of generating complete orthonormal bases here. So the parameter space, of course, is then very straightforward for us to write down. It's the space of momenta that carries the information that's in the original bijections, and then the space of functions f. And we're going to essentially do statistics on Gaussian random field models in the coordinates. So the momenta are indexed over the same template as the functions are, so the same complete orthonormal basis can be used or others. Here I'm implying that it's the same. It may not be. May not be the same complete orthonormal basis, even though they both sit on the same background space, the same coordinate system. And we basically work in these response variables, and this is where we do our statistics. In these, we model them as random response variables, we do means and variances and t-tests and all the rest. Now, to generate these complete orthonormal bases, we essentially do it two ways. We use PCA, which directly indexes over these structures. Well, often these structures are vertices, thousands of vertices, and we can do PCA. But if we want smoothness, we use the Laplace-Beltrami operator, a second-order operator, generalizes the usual Laplacian on the square in the plane to generate eigenfunctions. This is where we get smoothness. So the way to link it to what Bruce was talking about yesterday when he was talking about what he was doing with wavelets is there. He was on a curved coordinate system, and he was talking about how he's been working on how to generalize wavelets to curved coordinate systems. Well, in mechanics, people for a long time have generalized the notion of spherical harmonics and Fourier transforms. They're called surface harmonics. Spherical harmonics are a particular example. You basically compute them algorithmically. We have stable codes for doing that. That's how we do all of our work. Yeah. So the way to understand it is we like expanding time signals in sines and cosines. The generalization for the sphere is the Laplacian on the sphere. These are examples of the different eigenfunctions with different eigenvalues. Here's an example that Anshi used in her cortical surface work, and she'll also be showing cingulate work. So these are gyral, we're interested in gyral signals. So here's one of the gyruses. Here's the same gyrus, first function, second function, third function, and fourth. And here's a particular expansion of essentially a rectangle wave. This is positive and this is negative using these functions. Now, we have done this for the subcortical structures. So we have, Anshi has the plus Beltrami basis for every one of these structures. So if we want to look at these, for the amygdala, here's the first, second, and third such function. You can sort of see frequency is increasing in much the same way as for spherical harmonics, although this is we do this not with the spherical harmonic codes usually. Here's the hippocampus. Here's the caudate. Here's the globus pallidus. Here's the pterygium. So the second thing I wanted to point out is that we also compute principal components. So principal components can become collections of these kinds of functions that indicate variability in a population. And here's an interesting principal component. It's essentially the second principal component, which is showing a lot of variation in a particular ADNI population for these structures. And I point it out because I particularly like it, because it suggests that a lot of variance in the population between the controls, the MCIs, and the ADs is being captured by motions. If you look at zero motion, most of this is zero motion in the second principal component, but you're seeing it in the head of the hippocampus where we've always seen it in our isolated work in the amygdala, and then you're seeing an opposite, in the opposite direction, blue is in the opposite direction, the ventricle. So that's very satisfying. We of course should expect that this could be an important response measuring tool. I want to again emphasize that these functions are sitting on the boundaries of these structures. So we have a very reduced dimensional representation here. We're not, it doesn't have extent throughout. If you were to look at the vector field associated with this, it would be extended throughout the entire R3. But this is sitting on the boundaries of these structures. Then the statistical program is essentially shown here, where we have an MRI target. There's some segmentation. We push the template into it. We now have the bijection to the template. Through the bijection to the template, we carry whatever information. We then expand that information in the complete orthonormal basis that's sitting on the template, and then that allows us to do our modeling. And you're going to be hearing about examples. Let me show you one example in the heart because it's fun and it's different, and you'll be hearing about more brains and all brains this week. I also like this example because Sayan Akhartakhani came from UCLA, so he was a top draft choice for CIS about 2 years ago, and I know we've given you a few draft choices, but we got one, and he's a good guy, so he came out of one of your groups here. And so he's essentially looking at cardiomyopathy with Ray Winslow and Laurent Yunus. So here the imagery looks something like this, CT imagery. There's a very strong bone hardening artifacts in these because of the implants. The image gets essentially, the left ventricle gets isolated. From the left ventricle, you have a time series. We basically fit the hearts into these time series. We've looked at systole and diastole, and now we're looking at the whole range of time series. The overall process is the one that I described. You generate a left ventricle template. In this case, he's looked at end-systole and diastole. You end up with a template that's centered in the population. You then define mappings from the template onto the non- cardiomyopic and onto the diseased ones. Once you have these, then we can essentially encode the effect in functions that are indexed over the template coordinate systems. So here's an example just to show you how physical it becomes, and of course it always, we're basically doing a huge bag of feature reduction in this whole process. You know, one of the speakers yesterday talked about how, you know, the rage in computer vision now is bag of features, and then you have to select the bag of features by training and all of that. We should think about this whole analysis going from all those voxels that we deal with in voxel-based morphometry to a small number of dimensions. We're reducing to a very small bag of features here, right? So the second basis function is highly discriminating, it turns out, between the cardiomyopic and the non. And if you look at the second basis function, what it's doing, it essentially is signaling dilation at this location here in the template. If you look out two standard deviations, you flow the momentum along two standard deviations of this basis function. So you're in a very low dimensional submanifold of these diffeomorphisms. You flow along one direction, and you basically see it goes one way, and if you go in the other direction, it goes in and it goes out. And that's a discriminating direction. Now, if you prefer to work in the whole voxel setting, you can do that too. So here we're doing a non-parametric randomization test, correcting, of course, for multiple comparisons, and the color basically shows where in the template, if you look at the size of the vector fields or the momentum or the Jacobian, where the difference is. Now, I really want to get the slide up there because I just want to say that we should be expecting in the brain field, as whole brain mapping and region of interest mapping comes together, we're going to be seeing the mixture, the unification of all the voxel-based methods that, you know, Keith Worsley has talked about and done all of his beautiful work, and the Oxford group, with what has largely been these parametric methods in these local shape space representations that involve components that are things like PCA, and now we're using these Laplace Beltrami bases. Now I want to finish by essentially motivating what I see as the, you know, it is the next major tool that we needed in our studies, and that basically is, how do we transport function when it's on multiple templates or associated with multiple templates? So it's another kind of transport of function. So for that, Laurent Yunus and then Anchi has developed very nice programs for parallel transport for both dense images as well as point base. So let me just finish on this note. So I said in the beginning that transport, the transporting part of computational functional anatomy, once you have the bijections, however you get the bijections, it's a tricky business. So let's just call transport, the transport operation, with this nebulous notation, phi dot f. So we have the bijection, and somehow we move f. F is different things for different people, right? Often we've used group actions. So sometimes it's segmentation level. Sometimes it's bold response. Sometimes it's FA. Sometimes it's thickness, myelination depth. And we've always used group actions because we like them, because they have a property and we just like that. And so then we use phi center dot F, and we define it to be F composed phi inverse, phi acting on the right. But this is a tricky business. I just showed you that for vector information, it's a little trickier. Notice it's not just F composed with phi inverse. It's do a bunch of things to F, because you have to involve the fact that based on the transformation, how is the direction of the vectors at every point moving? You have to understand that. And what happens when our functional information is stored in multiple templates? How are we going to put that together? That's another kind of phi little dot f, yet to specify what phi little dot f is. Well, our phi little dot f, when you have multiple templates, is going to be parallel transport, which you're going to hear about. So why does this come up? Well, I'm going to call it, with a little bit of levity here, the Zernansky template, because John has spent a lot of time working on hippocampus and now thalamus and now other structures, and soon it'll be the whole subcortical network, because we have all these tools now. But this is one of his basic structures. Now, it's clear that the momentum that we measure and the PCA and the Jacobians, they're all indexed to this coordinate system. How do we share it? How do we give it to the Wiener group? How do we give it to the Oxford group, who are also doing it? We can't if they have a different template. So Anchi now has another template structure, right, that has a hippocampus on it. Well, it's a different structure. Now, how are we going to move the information here, the discriminating information, the response variables, over to here? Now, okay, maybe we would say this is not that important a problem. But let me just suggest that in time series, which we're all engaged in now, as we can tell from the talks yesterday, it's fundamental to time series. And why it's fundamental to time series is because it's so natural to use the person to encode themselves. That's the basis of delta modulation, right? Which has never been beaten in compression, right? Delta modulation is essentially encode yourself, the next part of yourself, through your previous self. So in that setting, it's so natural to call time zero the template and then push it through the time series, right? And 3 years ago, in fact, I think we started to have our own time series models that looked like, in that setting, time is real. Time is real. Data is entering at each of these time points. So there's not a single momentum that encodes it. Time is entering, and basically the observable is indexed in time, and the basic idea is that I0, the start point, is some flow at time t, and you build Gaussian around it if it's a simple Gaussian model. Well, the problem is, if you want to do cross-sectional things, you then have this is the template, and then this is the template, and this is the template. You've got all these templates. So you've got this information that's encoded in the flow that's carried by time zero through here, and then you got it encoded here, and you got it encoded here. How do you put it together? So our solution is parallel transport, and I think Laurent is not going to emphasize this, although I think it's in the second half of his talk, having looked at his talk. I know Anchi also has it, and there are now a series of three papers, I think, that are essentially out, showing that we can compute it on hearts, on brains, and I think it's an important tool for us for time series and atrophy and that's it. So thank you very much.